Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Poisoner's Cabinet. I'm Sinead.
And I'm Nick.
And this is your weekly podcast exploring the lives of the great poisoners, macabre murders and captivating crimes from across the centuries and creating curious cocktails inspired by the tales that we tell. And it's episode 165!
Yes, it is.
Well, we've got a different mic set up this week, and I will include this if the audio sounds weird, because Sinead forgot her DI box.
Yes, Sinead.
I was having a stressful day, and I forgot the mic, so now we're using the radio mics and the tiny little ones.
It'll be fine and delightful.
It will be fine and delightful. I just, I'm sorry if there's any popping, because I can't stay away from them, apparently. But yes, are you well? How are you, Nick?
Bumbling along.
Yeah, you're
bumbling along, surrounded by boxes still.
Yeah, still more boxes.
Still more boxes.
You had a big pile of solicitor's letters.
So many letters.
You're being sued.
So many very boring things.
Is it just relentless?
Oh, it's just dull.
No.
And it's just, there's a lot of legalese that doesn't need to be legally.
Legally, weirdly.
It's just very unnecessary. Okay, my house is not contaminated. Yay. Do I need a 400-page report to tell me my house is not contaminated?
Apparently you do.
Apparently I do. Yeah.
Apparently they were very thorough.
They were very thorough.
To be fair, I'm wondering why I asked you, because I'm bored of this already.
Yeah, so am I. I'm just bored of it all. I just got the keys.
Is anything else going on in your life?
No,
just this. Just this,
just this and boxing. Solicitors and boxes.
And it's humid as well.
And that's it.
Yes.
That's it forever and ever and ever and ever and ever.
Until you move, mate, and then it'll be fine.
Who knows when that...
Oh, well. Well, any poisonings this week?
Solicitors and boxes.
Don't poison the boxes. You need those to hold shit together.
That's true. I should probably wait for the solicitors until they have finished soliciting.
It's a different kind of thing.
It's a different thing.
They are not allowed to do that. Is that how they are working for you? Is that you have them working overtime?
Perhaps that's why they're so slow. They're just too busy doing other things.
They work hard for the money. So hard for the money. I don't know why they're doing that dance while soliciting. It's compelling as it is.
Compelling as it was, absolutely.
Yeah,
I'm aroused.
Absolutely. Oh, ew. Well, speaking of side hustles that may involve singing on the streets, and just being surrounded by boxes of promise and wonder, I think it's time for us to thank our delicious Patreon subscribers.
All my boxes are full of wonder, I'll have you know.
Are they?
Yes.
Even the ones with pants?
Even the one with pants. They are particularly wondrous pants.
Come with me and you'll see in these pants of pure imagination.
Have you seen the new Willy Wonka trailer?
You sent a video today of Hugh Grant as an Oompa Loompa, and I thought I was having a breakdown.
Absolutely, I love it.
Is it a new Willy Wonka film? I didn't know there was
one
coming out.
Yeah, it's the Willy, it's the origin Willy Wonka origin story.
Wow. Okay.
It's Timothy Chalamet is Willy Wonka.
Of course he is. Of course he is. Love him.
And yeah, it's how he became the big chocolatier sort of man. And yeah, just right at the end of the trailer, it's fucking Hugh Grant being an Oompa Loompa.
Yes.
I loved it.
You did.
It made me laugh.
To be honest, I was so busy today, I opened it and just went, nope, immediately. Like, that seems like that will set me over the edge. I don't know. It's probably great.
It's so dead bad. And it's watch it. It's so good. It made me chuckle at the end. Anyway, enough of that. On to the Oompa Loompa patrons.
The Oompa Loompa patrons are all orange.
They are all Oompa Loompas.
Oh, fantastic.
Especially Scott Fairman. Big Oompa Loompa.
To Leslie Weatherstone.
Spooky Vegan, definitely Oompa Loompa-ish.
Oh, yeah, that's very good. And to Kathy Oldenburg. Hooray! Wonderful. Thank you to all of our new listeners as well. We are continually gathering more and more listeners from around the world. We are delighted to have you with us. We're getting more followers. Some people joining us from TikTok because you love the arsenic green, apparently.
Who doesn't love a bit of arsenic green?
Tales of the Wallpaper and Darling, Darling Julia Tofana. I think we need to revisit her because she is an icon that is being worshipped on TikTok. Rightly so. Yeah. Thank you for joining us. Welcome. If you are diving into this episode as your first one, buckle
brave,
up.
Brave,
well brave. Done. Brave. Well, sometimes I worry/hope. For the people who start at episode one to see how far we've come.
Yeah, I can't say I've not listened to like episode one since like episode two came out.
I have.
And so I don't know if I want to listen to it because I'm thinking it's going to be really weird.
It's the first episode. It's the first episode of any podcast is always going to be your worst episode.
What we should do is we should redo episode one in our current modern sort of stylings. Oh, now we've become so much more comfortable with what we do.
Yeah,
and just
so.
Like see the difference between the two.
The first
so same
one,
cocktail.
We were terrified
because it was it Chapman?
It was Dr. Lamson.
Lamson
and the Dundee case.
So yeah, still got the recipe out. You've still got the script.
I assume so, somewhere.
Somewhere
I had the reams of paper research I did for episode one. And I have listened back. And guys, if you haven't gone back and listened to episode one, maybe you're newcomers, but for those of you who've been with us for a long time, just go back and listen and have a little giggle at how freaking nervous and serious we were on the first one.
I think you should do your first one and my first one. So my mum was
Peppermint Panic. The Bradford Sweets poisoning, which is a great story.
So, okay, I think we should do that.
Okay.
Re-record those.
I love it. When we start recording, you come up with marketing ideas. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, that's
so
a good idea.
I think that'd be interesting.
I think that's a really great idea. Oh, people, if you're on board, then go for it. Yeah. And this is the time where people weigh in going, yeah, can you redo that episode? Because it was shit.
Yes. Redo them all up until about 140.
Well, I mean, we could.
They're all a bit dodgy.
Yeah. Well, Nick, are you ready? To drink cocktails and talk about poison.
Dr. Lamson, let's do it. Let's do it.
It's not that.
Oh, fine.
Or we could drink poison and talk about cocktails.
I want a story. Tell me a story.
Oh, you are going to like it.
Okay.
So shall we go with the first one?
Yes, if that involves a story.
Let's go with the first one. Hooray, hooray, hooray. It is my story this week, but we can't possibly have a story without a cocktail in hand. As you know, dear listeners, every week we choose a secret ingredient that is inspired by the tale that we tell, and it will flavour our cocktail of the week. My story is my pick, and this week's secret ingredient is... A severed head.
Delightful.
Delightful.
Delightful. Who doesn't love? And I always go on about garnishes and how my cocktails lack garnish.
I didn't know where you were going with that.
So I think a nice severed head on the side.
I have not seen your brother in a while.
would be a delightful accompaniment.
Or is it the solicitors? Oh, nice. Okay.
I can learn how to shrink them.
Oh, shrunken heads.
Yeah, I can learn how to shrink heads.
Oh no, that's awful. Don't do that.
Don't do that. Okay.
Are they real?
Like stuffed with sand, hot sand, and sort of shrinks it down. And
we see you already know. I should learn. Clearly, you've been practicing up there. God knows what's in your attic. Okay, so
yes,
a severed head. Now, a few people have weighed in on Instagram. Finding a picture that I could put out on social media that would not be banned.
That's a very fair point. Yeah.
It is, because I was thinking of doing, shall I do some, paintings and mythology and everything, but then I found one. Of course, Tim, our darling friend Tim, the historian, weighed in, going knowing exactly who it was in the picture. I'm like, oh, actually, to be fair, I wasn't sure. But, yes. But lots of ideas and people going, but with a severed head as the ingredient, what have you come up with, Nick? Am I going to be annoyed?
I wouldn't have thought so. We're having a guillotine.
You're going to be very happy with this week's episode.
I thought it's potential that a guillotine may be involved somewhere.
I thought you might go down this road. I have no idea what's in a guillotine, but I just was thinking, I'm going to go for a guillotine. You know, it's perfect.
Marvellous.
It is perfect. It's perfectly appropriate. And I'm excited, actually.
Classic heading territory.
Yes. French-ish.
French-ish.
You'll learn.
Okay.
You will learn.
Okay.
If nothing in this episode, you will learn the bloody history of the guillotine. which is not intrinsic to the story, but it's fun.
But it's fun.
Yes.
Everyone loves some fun history.
Well, I think it is high time for us to raise our torches, revolution-like, and march into the poisonous cabinet kitchen.
Storm the kitchen.
We should... Hey! Oh, that's better. I'm going to do that again.
No, it's my idea. It's my joke.
Well, you can say it. No, based on Nick's joke just now, I think it is high time for us to storm into the poisonous cabinet kitchen and shake up a storm. So we'll see you in a minute.
We'll see you in a minute. Da, 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 da.
And we're back.
Hello.
So, Nick, the guillotine.
The guillotine
is beautifully blood red. This is a spectacular colour. Absolutely gorgeous. And do I detect an air of fizz?
An air of fizz?
Only because I heard you open the bottle.
That would be it. Yeah.
Oh, I like the look of it.
Delightfully French.
The red. What would you do to get this red?
Fizz and red.
Could it be Campari? Could it be some sort of food colouring?
Food colouring. Mainly food colouring.
Could it be the blood of the innocent?
Yes.
Or the blood of our enemies?
Could be.
The blood of the citizens. Yes, before we try, well, we've just worked out from all of our joking before we stormed the poisonous cabinet kitchen, this episode is actually coming out on Bastille Day.
It is. Bizarre coincidence.
14th of July, Bastille Day. So that is the anniversary of the storming of the Bastille.
Yes.
During the French Revolution, 1789. In fact, weirdly, Bastille Day is not the celebration of that day. It's the anniversary of the celebration that took place a year later.
Okay.
Yeah, but yes, the storming of the Bastille.
Do
you know a lot about the storming of the Bastille?
Not particularly.
It's not heavy in this story. It's just in the background of what happens.
Okay, all the aristos.
Because the Bastille was the symbol of the sort of the royal power, the prison, the big prison, and also a munitions store. So it had all the military artillery. So everyone stormed out and went, oh, we'll have some of that.
Have some of those guns.
But famously a prison, only 7 inmates at the time of the storming of the Bastille. And they included 4 forgers, a lunatic.
Nice.
A failed assassin.
Excellent.
And a deviant nobleman.
Nice.
So I kind of want to know the stories of all those guys.
Yeah, who doesn't have a deviant nobleman?
No, everybody. Everyone.
Yeah. Well, because Sard was in there for a while.
Was he?
I think so.
At the time.
Not at the time. No, no. Not at this point.
No.
But I think, yes, it's one of the places he was incarcerated.
Yes. It's a big, impressive place.
Oh, yeah, indeed.
But yes. It was, one of the many times. One of the many starts. This was the start of the French Revolution. There's a lot of those. But yes, happy Bastille Day.
Indeed. And to you.
But anyway, never mind that.
None of that.
Back to the drinks. Back to the drinks, my friends. Right, so the guillotine looks very beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm excited to try. So cheers. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Avant-toi santé.
Ooh.
Fizz. Good.
Fizz.
I'm getting fizz.
Other things.
And other things. Nothing really predominantly boldy, smash me in the face kind of thing.
No.
Which is good.
Yeah.
Because fizz is nice.
But nice other things. I'm getting some nice other things.
There's a fruity twang.
A fruity twang.
Is there a fruity twang in there?
There are some fruity twangs.
Oh, thank God. Because often I say a fruity twang and you go, there's never been a fruit anywhere near this.
No fruit anywhere near this.
Good dip, but dip. I don't know. Is there Campari in this?
No.
There's not?
Nope.
Well, I don't know then.
I don't know any other red things.
Shit. What? Chambord.
No.
That's French.
It is, yes, but no.
Me going like that isn't going to change anything, is it?
Think of the other red thing that's French. Classically French. Really, really, really French.
The red vermouth.
No.
The other thing is really French.
Really, 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 really... Okay, this is another thing that's really, really, really French. And red.
Shit. I don't... Everything
fruity.
Has gone out of my mind. But cherries, strawberries, what?
A drink.
It is a
fruity red one.
Clearly I'm panicking. I'm not capable of rational thought. What? French, fruity. No, stop saying fruity. Red, blood, what?
Cassis.
Oh, shitting fuck, what? God damn it, cassis. Right, okay.
Yeah, you know that stuff?
Yes, I do. I do, I know it well, I really like it. Right, some creme de cassis.
Creme de cassis.
So we got the makings of a Kir Royale.
And one other
or
thing.
A Kir Petion. And one other thing that makes it a guillotine. Deadly.
Deadly. Probably not quite so deadly.
All right. Is it...
Still fruity. Still think fruity.
Triple sec.
No.
Maraschino cherry.
Nope.
Banana.
We've not had it on the episode before.
Ooh, okay. New stuff. Oh, you had to order in new stuff, didn't you? Oh, interesting.
Well, I had to order in cassis because I didn't have any.
No, you didn't. Yeah, I've been saying that for years. Where is my cassis?
But so I've had two new things.
Pear.
Yes. That was a complete guess, but nicely done.
We've never had pear before. Oh, is it? So what's the pear liqueur?
So it's just it's an eau de vie, but it's made from pears. Poivre William.
Poivre William, that's it. Oh, I've always wanted to have that in a thing.
So now you've had it in a thing.
Yay!
So it's just, yes, it's some cassis and some pear. We'll stir it down with a bit of ice, make chili, and then just topped up with fizz.
Sorry, that's the only second sip I've had because I spent so long really guessing red things. That's delicious. Oh, that's good. Oh, I'm very happy.
That's good. I like that. I like that a lot.
Guillotine. I love that. You know what? That's a hit.
Yes, I believe so.
Now we can have more pear things.
Now we can have more pear things and more cassisi things.
Hey, I'm a happy bunny. Ooh. Well, there's not much else to say about it.
No, apart from not. Just it's very nice.
Everyone go and make one right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, cassis, not that expensive.
Not that expensive at all.
It's creme de cassis. It is a liqueur, isn't it? It's alcoholic.
It is alcoholic. Yeah, it's not strongly alcoholic. It's not like a Cointreau. It's like a 40%. So it's like a, I think it's like a 12 to 15 sort of. So a relatively low percentage in world of liqueurs. Because generally you would have it with.
And it is blackcurrant, by the way.
Yes. Remember having it as a kid when my parents used to have it with like white, well, you have it with a bit of white wine or something like that. Dad used to give it to us with some lemonade when we were camping in France.
How old?
So there's a camping. So they used to have it with some white wine or something, and he used to put a little thing, was just from like top it up with lemonade.
When you were six,
probably about 8 or 10 or something like that.
Bloody hell! This is why you are the way you are.
Topped up with
it?
Like a pint of lemonade.
To be fair, my parents were giving me whiskey.
Yeah, exactly. You were knocking back the brandy at that point.
Oh yeah.
And you were down the cellars of the local chateau.
Dancing.
Sampling the wines.
To be honest, I was old in comparison to all the other French kids.
With a nice cigar and some charcuterie.
And yeah, when I was in France, totally drinking wine the whole time. They're like, yeah, a little bit for you.
See, I was camping in France with my parents. Sinead was at her chateau.
Yeah, absolutely. Nick, that's
the family chateau.
That's so mean. My house was in the grounds of a chateau. Across the lake.
From...
Yes.
Yes.
We had a separate house for our diamonds, where we kept all the cassis.
Yeah. I was in the campsite with the poor people.
Yeah, we used to laugh at people.
I know,
like
absolutely.
You. Look at them drinking their watered-down cassis. Kill Royale, children. It was a magical time.
Absolutely.
Well, get some creme de cassis is the moral of this story. Also, if you've got Chambord left over from previous episodes, we always say just buy some of that. You could use a syrup if you didn't want to have the alcohol in it.
Yeah, you could do, absolutely.
Yeah. But the Poivre William, the pear liqueur, I'm going to be knocking shots of that back later.
Oh, good.
For no reason. There will be reasons.
Something to look forward to.
There will be reasons. No reasons that you will like.
No, just not good ones.
Okay, well, with our guillotines firmly in hand, are you ready for a story?
Mm.
So, with our guillotines in hand, you may get a hint or have had ideas of where we might be going this
I'm
week.
Sensing it may be a slightly French direction.
Is it? Do you think it might be French?
Might be French,
well, I tell you right now, Nick, you'd be right.
Ah, marvellous.
Yes. So you might be thinking, okay, severed heads, guillotine, which I was happy with. Oh, there may be some crime, some cases, some people. That might spring to mind.
There are many crimes involving guillotines.
Yes. All of which would be worth their own episode. But let's start with a crime, as is our wont. A little story. Now, this story is going to sound fanciful, but it is dramatic. And it's going to lead us to the meat of the matter of this week's episode.
Okay.
So we are in France in 1662. We're going to meet a soldier named Charles. Now, Charles has been wounded in his duties and he's in Dieppe. And he has been taken in by a peasant family. He needs some shelter. He's been taken in by them and attending to him. And he's struck by the beautiful daughter of the household, Marguerite. She's so beautiful. Oh, she's so lovely. He falls for her. Oh. And Charles is set on winning her heart. But while he is staying in this area, he hears from a cousin of the family who's also smitten with Marguerite. The cousin is a man.
Okay, yes.
And is smitten with Marguerite. But Marguerite does not return their affections. Mm. So Charles is like, well, hey. But the cousin he hears goes, I don't know. That's fine. I've got a sleeping draught.
Right.
I'm going to give Marguerite and basically have my way with her.
That's good.
Gross. Pretty gross.
Yeah, that's
now,
good.
Charles does not like this idea one bit.
I'm glad.
One bit. So he waits until he sees the cousin approaching the house. And he storms in there. Marguerite has been drugged, but the man has not had his way with her. And Charles fights him off, challenges to a duel, pushes him, he's got an accomplice with him, gets him out of the house. Yay, he's the most noble man in the world.
It's not gonna, no, he's not.
Sees her.
Yeah.
Unconscious.
Yeah.
So beautiful, he would relate a rite, allegedly. So beautiful, so absolutely beautiful, and he was ashamed to admit he took full advantage of the situation.
Yeah,
so,
that's less noble, I feel.
Yeah, yeah. If the transcripts of what he writes are to be believed, but yes, oh, her racked with guilt, he couldn't resist himself. Oh my goodness, oh, he was powerless
no
to resist.
Self-control whatsoever.
Assaulting a woman while she sleeps. So we started dark. Don't worry, it gets better. Ish.
Yeah, okay, right, yeah.
Charles escapes away the next morning, goes away, like, yes, he's to meet the cousin for a duel. When he gets there, the father of Marguerite is waiting. Authorities, the cousin's like, no, he totally did it. He totally drugged her. And it's like, well, he's absolutely right. But Charles is going to run away, but he must see Marguerite one last time. Over the course of the day, he goes back to the house to say goodbye to Marguerite. And as he would have it, as he wrote, he goes in and he sees Marguerite strapped to some sort of rack. Her father has forced her feet into torture boots.
Oh, fun.
Now we remember what torture boots are.
Spiky.
Well, they're boots that you put your feet into.
As one does with boots.
Starts off very well. Compressed.
Yeah,
compressed,
jolly.
Compressed. Now, how far this compression has gone, we don't know, but she allegedly is being tortured. Her father is beating her with an iron rod, screaming, confess, confess, accusing her of all sorts of harlotry. Charles goes, no, I will marry her. I love Marguerite. I'm madly in love with her. Apparently, Marguerite says, I'm madly in love with him too. Really? Really? Does she? Well,
he's going to get me out of those boots.
He's
going to
get her
like
out of the boots. She's like, absolutely fine. He says, I will marry her. I will make an honest woman of her. Please don't torture her. Clearly has love and affection for this woman. Mm. But the father turns around and deals him a devastating blow. Yes, you will marry my daughter. And you are going to take on my profession as a result. You are going to become an executioner.
Oh. So why?
Ah. I shall explain.
Is it a profession passed down through the daughter?
It is a profession passed down through generations.
Yeah. Yes.
This seals both their fates. She's married to her rapist. She doesn't really get a say in the matter.
Oh, God, no.
But Charles, his fate is sealed, and his family's fate is sealed for generations. Because becoming an executioner means shame and dishonour, not only on him, but every son. And his son's sons, and his son's sons, and his son's uncles, brothers, and other sons. Because we are dealing with the Sanson family.
Mm.
Yes, today's story is all about executioners. And the most famous executioner family, apart from one British one, possibly.
Yep. Maybe one.
The Sanson family, six generations of executioners in France, the killers of criminals. And their story is so interesting that I thought, okay, crime adjacent, executioner.
Well, definitely crime related, absolutely.
Crime related, but that little bit of folklore there was like, oh great, their family started with a crime, okay,
nice, let's
fair
go
enough.
With that.
Now, whether that's to be believed or not, or whether that is...
I'm sure there's an artistic license in the history.
yes. Everyone, well, the generations of families would write memoirs over the centuries, grandsons, great-grandsons and everything, and tell the story and very much been glossed over.
Got elaborated and things over time.
Elaborated. I don't know why they would tell that story, by the way.
It's quite a gruesome start to the family profession, isn't it?
Sort of, grandfather was a rapist.
Yeah, but I can't imagine they led with that.
Oh, they did. Luckily, executioners weirdly did keep journals. Now, there are a couple of very famous examples, one of which I was going to do this story on and then read about the Sanson and go, oh no, I've got to start with them. There's another very famous execution that I may come back to, which is very well documented. Within the story, there are also many, many other options for stories. So I encourage listeners, if you hear anything that you go, no, I want an episode on that, jump in, because these executioners will cross paths with all manner of people. So first up, executioner. Glamorous job, Nick?
Glamorous, probably not the word for it, I think.
What would you see as an executioner in the 1600s, 1700s? This is the kind of era we're dealing
with. Yeah, I would imagine it's probably not a particularly popular job, not a particularly popular career choice. I imagine it's probably fairly well paid.
Okay.
If you're going to sacrifice an awful lot to do, there must be some sort of
recompense,
some sort of bonus for doing such an unpleasant thing that everyone is going to hate you for.
Well, you're absolutely right. Well done.
Well done, me.
Well done,
me.
More booze for you.
Yes. And so I know sort of prisoners would also pay their executioner.
Yeah.
For their for sort of a swifter beheading or a sharper axe or
indeed
just make it less uncomfortable.
There's all sorts of stories like that that they could, you know, that they're bribing them and that they're, you know, they're asking for clemency and leniency. Absolutely. And the executioner is going to cross paths with everyone in society, from the lowest of the low to the highest of the high. But the reality of an executioner is a confusing one. It's the most confusing job ever, possibly. An executioner in the eyes of the public, exactly as you said, outcast. Yeah. The lowest of the low. The kind of person who is, if you are killing your fellow man, regardless of you being paid, if they are, you know, atrocious criminals, you are an outcast. No one wants to associate with you. To the point where historically executioners had to live outside of the city. They could not reveal their name. Famously, the hoods.
Big old hood.
Big old hood, masks, all those sorts of things. So your identity would never be revealed, so no one could ever come to you, whether you were the family of a victim.
Yeah, or absolutely.
Just a member of society who didn't like the look of you and like, how could you possibly do this, even though we all support capital punishment?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
You can imagine, like, yeah, someone gets executed and the son is out for revenge or something like that to avenge their father's death. So you can imagine, yeah, you need to be anonymous. Otherwise, you can have all sorts of people day and night trying to do you in.
And I'm sure probably too big a debate to get into right now, but people must have thought the same thing as we would now. How could you possibly do it? What goes through your mind to be able to do that again and again and again? Because there's not a lot of executioners. They have assistants, but you've usually got one executioner for an entire city, an entire district, entire area, who is doing the job, because it's a thankless job. As we said before, you said about a job being passed on through generations. That's how executioners worked back then. If you were an executioner, your family kind of had to pick up the axe. Quite literally. The axe, the sword, whatever's your poison.
Yeah.
It would stay in the family. The family's name is Mud. The family's name is Mud, but well paid. So you're shunned by society, living in secret, not allowed to go to the social events, not even allowed to go to church in some places. Your sons, your brothers, any male would carry the profession and the family name is tarnished. You are not really allowed to be a citizen in France. You are not allowed to be a member of society. You are not allowed to... Certain land ownership is banned from you. You know, you can only marry certain people. Who's going to want to marry into the family? How do you continue the family line? It's pretty shitty. Pretty shitty. But it's a necessary evil.
Someone's got to do it.
Capital punishment, all the rage.
Yeah.
All the rage. No one's saying don't kill people. Mm. So it's a position, as you said, is very well paid. Executioners had huge salaries. Really big salaries. So there's some in the 1600s, even back to the 1500s, who would earn the same amount as lawyers at the time. Lawyers, famously rich, as well you know.
Quite wealthy.
You're paying them right now. Yeah. They just could enjoy themselves with all their wealth. So they had good big old houses.
Big old houses, nice old feast.
And certain people who
and
were...
no friends.
Yeah. Well, you get married and so, like, oh, you know, I'll have some of that finery, but you just can't really enjoy it that much. Great author Joel Harrington, who wrote a book called The Faithful Executioner about Franz Schmidt, who is someone we should probably do another episode on as well. I was going to do the episode on him and I was like, oh no. Talked about executions at the time in this sort of time period, so between the 1500s and 1700s, it's showing society that shit was getting done by the authorities. We've talked before about law enforcement being kind of, can you guys deal with it, people on the streets, and then we'll punish them later. It's very much... the punishment is their way of showing something's happening. So that's why...
And also a deterrent as well, I feel. To make it as brutal as possible to try and...
Yeah.
Don't do this, because we're shit investigating and stopping it. But if it does happen, then this is what's going to happen to you.
Exactly. it's sort of a deterrent to say, yes, we will absolutely mess you up. Deterrent, but also a show to the public.
Oh, for sure.
It is those two things together. But it's more of a display, like, we can do stuff. This deterrent, whether it stopped people committing crimes or not, was debatable. It was more to show, no, we do have a function. It's ridiculous, really. It's kind of a vicious cycle of like, all right, well, is anyone not committing crimes? No, but when we catch them, oh, we'll give them hell. People are still committing crimes. Prison wasn't seen as punishment. Prison was a holding cell to your punishment. So being locked up for years and years and years while they decided what to do with you was not seen as a punishment.
No, absolutely.
No rehabilitation. None of that. No one cares about that. No. Absolutely. How do we get you to death or transportation?
Yeah. Well, at that point, if you're evil, you're evil.
There is no saving.
There's no coming back from that.
And that's the debate as well about capital punishment, and a lot of executioners had when they were wrestling with the moral dilemma of it, going, are we helping people to their salvation? Are we helping people to the Lord? The greater good of them being saved, because we can't save them on earth. A lot of executioners clung to that idea.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
While being paid to kill people. Make an example of someone, as I said, is a two-edged sword, literally. The executions were historically brutal, but there were repeated and ongoing calls from executioners and campaigners to make them more humane in the interests of the crowd. So you've got entertainment, you're like, hey, execution. But if the person suffers for too long,
then the crowd's going to turn on you. The
crowd's going to feel pity.
Yeah.
Pity for the person. Oh, no, that's not nice. No. The idea of someone being hanged and burned to death and pincered. It's like, sounds fun at the time, but then after 15 minutes.
There's only so much screaming that one can take, I feel.
Exactly. It's not the point of execution is to get some pity.
But yeah, but before the snack stales go really downhill.
Everyone's going, this is getting upsetting.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is the golden age, as it were, of execution and...
Creative methods.
There's no long drop.
Oh, no, absolutely.
There's... At this time when the Sanson family start becoming executioners, it's everything flies. Everything that you could possibly do with your human being. Oh, do that.
Yeah,
do that. It'll be fun. Most of the executioners had been people with shady pasts. So there were people who were brutes, the kind of people who were like, oh, I don't give a shit about mixing with society, get some money. But there were others who were respectable, good families, good education. And the blow to them would always be greater. Many executioners spent their lives around all of the executions they were performing, begging and pleading for honour to be restored to their family so they could clear their name for future generations. Back to the Sanson family. Mm-hmm. So the Sanson family are legendary as executioners because of the number of them, the generations that performed executions and all the people they killed. Because there's some famous ones in there. But how did it all start? Well, upper middle class family. Good family from France, the Abbeville region. I'm going to state right now, 90% of people in this story are called Charles. They have middle names that is helpful.
Okay.
But just drink through it.
Yeah, if, no, absolutely. Just go Charles.
Trust me, most of this was me trying to pick apart the bits of the timeline.
Which Charles was Charles?
I read so many articles that I had no idea, and they just wrote Charles over and over and over again.
Because France, they have a list of names, and you can only have those many names. And most of those names are Charles.
Yeah.
The only name they're allowed to pick.
Meet Charles, Louis, and that's it.
Yeah, pretty much. And Pierre.
Pierre, Henri. You can go back so far and there's nothing. And there's Charles. Everything in every middle name is a variant on that. So we started with Charles Sanson du Longval, who was the first in line of the executioners. Now, if we are to be believed, the short story is he married the daughter of an executioner. Mm. His memoirs, it was written by his great-great-great-grandson later, romanticised it weirdly to a point. That's how he started. Married into the executioning ways, becomes the executioner of Paris in 1688. Marguerite, the woman he gave up everything for, would die in childbirth with their first son. So that was, they all got screwed there. So Charles takes the job slowly, fainted at his first execution.
Well, one would, I feel.
Yeah, you've got to think that the families that have to do this, you got no choice. You're going to get up on the scaffold and then watch this shit.
And it's probably not like you get a lot of practice.
No, you really can't. So,
it's not something you can really rehearse, is it?
I was going to say with watermelons, but they weren't prevalent really in rural France.
And also probably don't give you the same reaction. Imagine I could probably hack a watermelon into pieces, but put a live person in front of me, I may go, ooh, that's not quite the same.
Yeah, they're crying a lot.
Yeah, so.
So when we've got executioners, before they rise to the official rank of executioner, they have assistants or they're helping the others and then they become the official executioner. He was the official executioner over a well-known noblewoman named Angélique Nicole Carlier-Tiquet.
Ooh.
Delicious.
Delightful.
She'd hired men to kill her husband.
Oh.
Apparently it was by poisoning.
Excellent. Nice done.
Being noble, she was spared the horrors of being hanged and hanging back then, choking to death for 10 minutes. Sure. Or any other torture. Noble means beheading.
Yeah.
Quick blow with a sword. Done.
If you're good with your aim.
Mm. We're not on Anne Boleyn territory here. Yeah. We have a special French swordman flown in with like a perfectly sharpened knife and then gone in one failed swoop. Took him 3 goes to cut her head off. And the way it's written is that with every blow, blood just went all over the crowd. Like, way, way.
Well, there is going to be a certain sort of splash zone, isn't there?
you hit
an artery, it's going to go.
Yeah, just hacking at her head. 3 times the head came off. Apparently her face looked really serene still afterwards.
Did it?
Yeah. So, blood-soaked crowd, lovely.
Lovely. Do they get, like, ponchos? like you do in, like, Disneyland
they got
or something.
Bladders. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. They're just, like, holding up children in front of them, like, hey! But now to the line of succession.
Okay.
This is where it gets fun. Okay. So this Charles had an older son called Charles who inherited the role, but then he died. Ah. Luckily, he had another son called Charles.
Called Charles. Excellent.
Yeah. Charles the Younger took his place. So that Charles, Sansor, grew up, married a woman named Anne Marthe, and he took control of the sword. Mm-hmm. He had 2 sons.
Charles and Charles.
When he died in 1736, Anne Marthe was very keen that the sons continue the line. She's quite a driving force. There's not a lot written about her other than that she was, I like this lifestyle, I like the money, fuck going out, you guys are going to carry on.
I get a good position at all the executions. I'm in the fancy box.
Yes. Now, those sons were Charles Jean Baptiste and Nicholas Charles Gabriel. There's just a Charles in everything.
Charles.
But Nicholas as well. Yeah. You've got Gabriel in there as well. They're both just children at the time of their father's death, but the execution work is carried out
by tiny swords.
Well, they literally have to grow up on the scaffold because the assistants, and there's a sort of a holding pattern before the seven-year-old can get hold of the axe. They help the assistants. They grow up just like being splattered
with
blood.
Is one of them on the other one's shoulders and they've got a big coat?
Falling down from the sheer weight of the axe, breaking on the wheel. They're just there threading themselves through it as well. But this is the days of the threading, you know, the broken on the wheel, burning and all sorts of things. They help out. They grow up. Jean-Baptiste takes over. He takes over as the lead executioner. He would go on to have 16 children, 10 of whom lived. He was practicing on them. No, he wasn't practicing on them. It's like the wife is terrified.
He's practicing with his wife, by the sounds of it.
He does. More children. No, not this one. 10 survived. Apparently, it was all fine. They worked in the family trade, but it was his first son, Charles Henri Sanson, who would be the most famous Sanson executioner. And generally history thinks too.
Okay.
So we've gone through the line of succession.
We've got a lot of Charles.
Executioner. So Charles Henri was born in 1739. Not keen to take up the family business. It's pretty gross.
Yeah, it wouldn't be my first choice, to be honest.
No, he goes to school, good family, good education. From the get-go, he's not interested. That does make it sound like he came out of the womb going, no. He didn't. He learned to speak and then went...
Then went, no.
No. Didn't come out going, I'm not cutting off any fucking heads. Goes to school, he's got his sights set on becoming a doctor. Studies medicine.
He wants to heal people.
He does.
He wants to make people better.
He really does. He really does. And in the past, you've got executioners way back when, we can cover another episode, like Franz Schmidt, who was a healer. Who was a healer as well as an executioner. So real interest in anatomy. Mm-hmm. Don't know where that came from. But he's studying at school until some of the other parents find out who his daddy is. They find out he's the son of an executioner. There's a whole transcript in the memoirs that a child is drawing pictures of him being an executioner, his dad being an executioner and handing them round. But the long and the short of it is the family find out going, that kid's father is an executioner. He is asked to leave the school. He's kicked out of the school, has to go into private education because no one will be associated with an executioner family. Despite his efforts to find another career path, his family, particularly grandmother Anne Martha, were insistent, take up the job. You have to do it. It's a job that needs to be done. There's no getting away from it. So not only would he have to be lead executioner one day, but the current executioners also needed assistance. So he had to help his dad as soon as he said, okay, fine, right, you're on the scaffold.
Yeah,
no matter
get
what.
Get up there.
Yeah.
Here's a mop.
Wrangle prisoners in there, clean up the mess, arrange the equipment, do a little dance, warm up the crowd.
Exactly.
As I've said, we're in the golden age of executions. So, do you want to remind people what Breaking on the Wheel is?
Lovely, there's a golden age.
I've decided to call it that. Okay. Some people, some historians sort of call it that. It's like execution's absolutely fluke. Well, because this is before a very important period where people went, fuck no.
Yeah, went, mm.
Because by then, Breaking on the Wheel, boiling in oil, drownings, hangings that weren't hangings, they were just throttling you for 15 minutes.
A damn good stretching.
Battering you senseless with various things in weird positions. This was it. It's like, if you want a golden age of execution, go, well, this is weird. This was the time. So you're sort of up on the scaffold, and when Charles Henri is up there going, well, I mean, if I can cope with this, I can cope with anything.
True.
So do you want to remind people of the famous breaking of the wheel?
Yeah, it's a delightful thing.
Mm.
Basically, you got a big old wheel, big old cartwheel,
yeah.
And they break your arms and your legs and your bones and everything, yeah. And sort of throttle you through the spokes.
Mm. And then leave you.
And then leave you just hanging around.
Yeah, that's going to sound real nice in comparison with what happens next.
And then they chuck you on a fire.
Oh, yeah, then they clean up. Clean up. Yeah, breaking on the wheel, lovely.
Yeah,
in comparison.
Delightful.
To what happens if you attempt regicide.
Is this a drawing and quartering type affair?
Yeah. So Charles Henri was assistant to his uncle, Nicholas Charles Gabriel Sanson. That's another load of names.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. It's just Nicholas. Uncle Nicholas does not stay in this story for long because of what happens. He is in charge of the execution of Robert François Damiens. So Damien. Do you know who he is?
Nope.
Okay.
From context, I'm assuming he tried to kill the king.
He did. Well, this is something of a madman, domestic servant who went a bit mad, decided that he needed to kill Louis XV.
Fun, okay.
So he stormed the grounds of the Palais de Versailles and went at the king with a penknife.
Okay.
And it's a tiny knife, went at him.
So not going to get through 15 layers of silk, isn't it, really?
This was in winter as
and
well.
Jewels.
It was in winter. Stabbed it, just flesh wound.
Yeah.
Flesh wound, but he got past the guards and he injured the king. Now, this is a scratch because of the sheer amount of clothing in there, but he was terrified, frightened, you know.
As one would be.
Someone has come at
me. Someone's trying to kill
me. And when the blood starts pouring, he thinks that he has been mortally wounded. Calls for a priest, calls for a confessor, and then calls for the queen and starts apologising for all the affairs he's had.
Nah, nice. And like, you're fucking all right, you're fine, mate. Doctor and priest there going, you're fucking fine.
Yeah, he's like, it's Louis XV. So she's like, I know, yeah. I know. He's like, no, babe, it's so much worse. There's so many more
you
that
have
you don't
not
know about.
Been subtle.
No, it got really weird once. Yeah, so he must be furious when he finds out there's a scratch. Oh, Queenie, by the way, none of that happened. Whether it was because he was attacked or also he found out, shit, I've just confessed to a lot of stuff. He is not lenient.
No.
On this man. It's the first attempt at regicide in over 100 years. About 150 years, I think it is. Throws the book at him. I believe the shit I got involved with my wife. He didn't even try to evade capture. He is routinely tortured by the Sanson family to reveal his co-conspirators. He gives no names. So then it's on the 28th of March, 1757, that he is brought to the Palais de Greve to be drawn and quartered.
Nice.
So we start off with a standard pinching of the flesh with hot pincers.
A standard pinching.
Pinching. So hot pinchers pull the flesh off your bones.
Nice.
Oh, lovely. A special pincers they got for that occasion.
Gold ones.
Yeah, they could handle them nicely. Then the hand with which he held the knife is burned with sulfur.
Fun.
Got a mixture of molten wax, molten lead, and boiling oil poured into any wounds on his body.
Fine. The wax I could probably cope with.
Sorry, what?
Well, I mean, wax, yes, it's hot, but it doesn't... It's not fatal.
No.
But the
it's not kinky, Nick. Let's just not go body of evidence.
No, I'm just thinking, if you're going to use why wax? It seems like a...
To seal it?
How's that going to seal it?
Because I suppose that would seal the lead and the sulfur. It's not going to let it pour out, maybe.
Well, no, because the lead and the lead is going to be so hot that the wax is just going to melt anyway.
These
so.
Were debates that the executioners had around the
yeah,
table.
Like,
why are we wasting good wax?
Why are we wasting good wax, mate? Absolutely. Make some candles.
Create an ambiance.
Yeah, exactly. Make it spooky.
But it's Halloween in but a few months.
I think the lead is going to do it. I think the molten lead is...
It's the fucking king wants it to look bougie. That's what it is. So he's full of shit.
Perhaps there was a delivery of 400 candles. Okay, what the fuck are we going to do with all these candles? King going, make it look really bougie. He wants them everywhere and make it look really cool. But they've gone, we only need four. It's not a big room. So what do we do with them? We've got to do something with them. They've been delivered. Fuck them, Alamo. Chuck them in it.
Stick them in their corpse. Interesting enough, bougie is the French word for candle.
There we go.
Anyway, so he's filled up with stuff.
That's very nice.
I like it. Genitals ripped off.
Of course.
By Nicholas and Charles H. They were like, how do we do it? Oh, fuck it.
One inch.
Three. There's three bits.
Oh, there's three bits, aren't there?
Oh, the penis comes off as well. And then he's torn apart by horses.
Nice.
His arms weren't coming off quick enough. Or the horses were slow and fat. So they had to kind of go at his tendons with a knife.
Yeah, you've got to get through the muscle there, haven't you? Yeah, you've got to get through those ligaments and things out of the way.
This was seen as a little bit of a note afterwards of like, yeah, they had to actually go at it with a knife. You know, it's like, bodies are difficult. Torn apart, torso left, hurled onto the fire, ashes scattered to the wind.
Nice.
He died at some point during that.
Quite early on, one would imagine.
Well, some say it wasn't until, well, poetically, they say it wasn't until the last limb was pulled that he died. I would have died looking at all of that.
Yeah, exactly. I would have just flung myself off the ramparts or something, girl.
Well, then they wouldn't let you, would they? I would have died of fright the second a pincer came towards me.
No, absolutely. I would have done something just to get it over and done with. And you don't
know.
Try and attack someone. Try and rush someone. Not thinking you're going to escape, but just try to.
But you're in chains. They want their
hold
show.
Hold your breath a lot. Until you pass out or something.
It looks like you're having a tantrum. Like you're going purple, like, no, I won't go to the big torture ring. They're like, you're going
whether you want to or not.
Yeah, like, it's a beautiful day out.
Excellent day for pincering.
As well as that, obviously, anyone who tries to commit regicide, house raised to the ground, entire family banished from France, have to change their name. Don't give the king a paper cut.
Go to do it properly.
After this display, Uncle Nicholas retires. Early, like, fuck this shit, I'm out. That's horrific. That is like,
imagine one could after that affair. You can't beat that, can you?
We're joking about it. He absolutely has no stomach for it after that because Nicholas is not supposed to be the executioner. He's sort of standing in until Charles comes of age. Charles Henri is like, right, if I can deal with that, I can deal with anything. He has been hardened to this, and as his father's health begins to fail from a stroke in 1778, Charles Henri receives the blood red coat from his father,
nice. Which
is the symbol.
Symbol of his office.
Of the executioner. I don't know if that's an official symbol or whether his dad just gave it to him and he went, what's this? And just put it on. Shut up.
Has it been washed for 400 years?
No, you know what? No, I don't want your horrible death coat. I'm fine with my jerkin.
Yeah.
Charles Henri takes up the position of Paris's official executioner with his team of assistants. His own sons will later join with him, work with him and carry on the legacy. During these early days in his role, Charles Henri lived a mixed life. Yes, he's getting very well paid. He is a man of a good family and a good education, but still, he's an executioner. He must be shunned. He must be pushed away from any civilized society. But he continues to fight, I guess, for the rights of executioners, arguing very eloquently, why is my name mud when you are paying me and you're saying this has to happen? He goes to, in 1789, we have the newly formed National Assembly, who are just on the side of, like, oh, fuck the monarchy. They are reviewing the status of executioners and they deny them. They deny them their right to civil liberties, civil status. They say it is in the soul of all good men to shudder at the sight of one who murders his fellow creatures.
That you told me to murder.
Mm. Charles Henri wrote to the assembly himself and said to deny the rights of an executioner while demanding their service was the height of hypocrisy.
I agree.
In his words, he said, either conclude that crime must remain unpunished or that an executioner is needed to punish it. And it's so simple.
That sounds entirely fair.
What are you doing? We want to make him the pariah, but we want to pay him and say it's all right. But he was about to become pretty, pretty influential in upgrading the dispatchment of criminals.
Okay.
Establishing a rather fetching piece of machinery. And that's going to figure quite a lot.
Is it?
In France's history. Or the future where he's concerned. I think that might be time for another drink.
Definitely.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So, Nick,
Have
you heard of the guillotine?
No, not until this cocktail.
I've never heard of it. What a thing of wonderment.
Yes.
What a strange contraption it is. No, so the guillotine, when was the guillotine invented?
I have no idea.
Right, no attempt at it.
Well, I one had assumed it was sort of a French, 1700s sort of device. Mm-hmm. I have a suspicion you're going to say, oh no, it was invented by the ancient Babylonians in 300 BC or something.
Was it?
I don't know. I can imagine it's not French, though. Everyone thinks it's French, but it's not French.
Well, the guillotine is. The guillotine is. I wasn't.
Lies.
No, well, the guillotine is, but it's a version of things that have existed for a long time.
I'm sure there's always been head chopping off devices.
Well, the Halifax gibbet.
Chinese-y thing.
The Halifax gibbet.
Nah.
Back in the 13th century. So this is like an axe head. So like lots of weights and stuff like that, and then cutting down. And the Scottish maiden. In Scotland, used for a very long time. And these contraptions were the basis for the guillotine. So by the 1780s in France, Charles Henry, amongst many other people, are calling for better equipment. From his perspective, he's like, okay, there are a lot of people who need executing.
Yeah, it's exhausting.
It's a lot. It's a lot. And also there's a revolution. I need better equipment, faster, more humane is just better for my team. Better for audiences. Also, I've got to pay for all the equipment I use right now. And I'm going to pay for my assistants. And I'm going to pay for maintaining them. This is a lot of admin. And I'm very tired. But there are also campaigners who are very strongly against the death penalty. And are at least trying to say, look, if you're going to have the death penalty, can it not just be fire and sulfur and wax? All of the wax? Can we please get rid of that? They are saying, just have something faster and more efficient and more humane than what you've been doing. Evidence.
Fair.
So the name guillotine comes from Joseph Ignace Guillotine. Not the inventor, was a campaigner against capital punishment. He was totally against capital punishment, in so many words. Debated with Louis XVI and said, if you're going to do this, can we come up with something better?
Let's do it nicely.
Let's do it nicely. Anything is better than all of this. It was surgeon Antoine Louis. The original name for the guillotine was a Luette, an engineer named Tobias Schmidt. No relation to the earlier executioner. Tobias Schmidt was an engineer who made musical instruments.
Nice.
He was a good friend of Charles Henry. They are the ones who build the prototype of the guillotine in consultation with Louis XVI and Charles Henry. So they're all talking about what can be done. Let's look at the Halifax gibbet. Let's look at the Scottish maiden and let's build something that is appropriate and quick. And it's Louis XVI himself who says it needs to be a straight angled blade rather than a curved blade like an axe. He chooses the blade of the guillotine. Mm-hmm. That won't come back to haunt him at all. And it's Charles Henry who was the first executioner to use the guillotine. He did all the tests with hay bales. live sheep.
Well, yeah.
And then corpses. Yeah. So the sheep were probably unnecessary, mate. Just as a lot of bleating, and also it's not the same.
Well, I suppose a live thing is going to give different than a dead
wriggling
thing.
Wriggling and yeah. Can we hold it in place? I mean, it's
and on a corpse as well, it's probably going to start getting a bit more squidgy than a live thing.
Quite so
it's
fresh, fresh.
So it might come apart easier, one would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, the sheep is a small part of the whole moral argument here, really. If that's the hill we're going to die on, then I think that we peak too soon. On the 25th of April, 1792, Charles Henri executed Nicolas Jacques Pelletier, who was the first man ever executed by guillotine.
Mm-hmm.
He was a robber. He had killed someone in the street. Everyone turned out.
Fancy device.
Well, yeah, he'd actually asked for the National Guard, the equivalent of National Guard, excuse me, to sort of man the area, because we'll have big crowds. I think it was a fairly normal crowd. The guillotine was painted red.
Well, you don't want to get splatters of blood all over it.
Well, that's
you?
It. There's,
you don't want to paint it white, and then it's like, ooh.
I think later on the guillotines weren't red. They were just, like, why did we paint it red? That's weird. There's going to be blood. And also, no paint that we have matches blood. Painted red, prep for the day, like lightning. Because Charles Henri wanted to get the shit over with. And he wanted to show how fast it was. Execution done in seconds. And the crowd booed.
He hadn't suffered enough.
They were shouting, it's way too quick, bring back the gallows, they're called. But the guillotine was here to stay. And what timing, because things are really going to kick off. Mm. The French Revolution has been bubbling away now for a few years by the time of the guillotine's inception and its use, which is in 1792. The French Revolution has been going for about 3 years-ish. Shit is going down.
Yeah, there's a lot happening.
It's not constant storming. Yes, there was the storming of the Bastille, but then there's a lot of talk. There's
a lot of chat, yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot of fervor and there's a lot of fights and things like that, but it's not wall-to-wall violence. There's a common misconception.
A lot of cake as well.
It's a lot of brioche.
A lot of brioche going around the place.
It's just Kirsten Dunst looking fabulous. Charles Henri is now the chief wielder, as it were, of the guillotine, and everyone starts to love it. Mm. Everyone loves it. And he becomes a bit of a celebrity. So there's some writing of the time that says, describing him, handsome and well-formed. He possessed a superior intellect and an excellent education. He was extremely elegant in his habits and attracted so much attention by the richness of his dress that a somewhat arbitrary measure was taken, which forbade him to wear blue because it was the colour of noblemen.
Mm.
His manner of protesting consisted in adopting still more gorgeous costumes of green cloth. He even made the colour fashionable. And the beau of the court copied the cut and the colour of his garments and wore the coats a la Sanson. So yeah, he was a trendsetter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everyone
was
wearing his
clothes. Fashion icon.
Absolutely gorgeous. Not allowed in court. Don't fucking come near me. The flip side of this, another brilliant story from Charles Henri, from his memoirs. One night he was dining at an inn, a respectable inn, lovely place, has a conversation with a marquess. Putting the world to rights, very respectable, very nice. She's talking to him. Respectable people, nothing untoward at all. Told her he was an officer of the parliament. Very pleasant. As he goes to leave, another patron calls to the woman saying, do you know who that man is? And she says, well, he's an officer of Paris. And he goes, oh yes, an officer, the executioner of Paris, just come from supervising another execution. At these words, apparently, the Marquess nearly fainted, becoming speechless and in her confusion shed tears, and in remembering that she had shook hands with him, asked for a basin of water to wash her hands.
Get over yourself, love.
Gets better.
Okay.
She left. Immediately goes, petitions Parliament that he be sentenced to beg for her pardon for having the audacity to talk to her, and he must do it on his knees with a rope around his neck.
Right.
Also, for the safety of the public, he should henceforth wear a distinctive sign so that all should know him.
Okay.
Yeah. Just for speaking to her demands
such audacity.
Parliament that he come to her with a rope around his neck pleading this, and also has to wear a big sign saying, I'm an executioner. That went to court.
Mm.
That went to court and he was acquitted. He was acquitted.
Mad. Crazy lady.
Allegedly that happened. I should say. I can well believe that it did.
Yeah,
I can well believe that a Marquess would just go, oh, me, I've been dishonoured. Now, whether it's being a fashion icon or being a pariah, Charles Henri is busy as ever. He was entitled also to keep any of the possessions of the dead.
Nice.
Who came up on the scaffold. So go through the pockets.
Nice few perks.
Yeah, the hair that you cut off because of the guillotine and everything. Sell that. Clothes had to go to the poor. Boo. But soon his fame would exceed all expectations when he was called up to the ultimate role, the execution of Louis the 16th.
Yeah, that'll make you famous.
Yeah, was not expecting that.
I can't imagine he was, no. It must have been quite an unexpected letter to receive.
So apparently he was a royalist. He was a supporter, but he's the executioner. It doesn't matter which side you land on. You've got to...
do your job.
Do what you're told. And basically the state, the country, has said, kill the king. Okay.
Okay.
Right. Great. So it's Louis the 16th is going to come to the scaffold. And everyone's like, wow, we're going to turn up for this. It's in 1793. The king arrived at the scaffold. He, at first, Louis the 16th refused to hand over his coat because his assistant said, give me your coat. And he would, no, I like my coat. I'm paraphrasing here,
it's
obviously.
It's my coat.
It's my coat, but I like my coat. And then they go, no, no, we need your coat because we need to tie your arms. He went, I don't want you to tie my arms at all. I don't want to keep my coat and I don't want you to tie my arms. And so eventually he goes, no, no, oh, no. Then they say, look, Jesus was bound. Jesus was bound at his end. And Louis goes, okay, all right.
I've been on Jesus.
Oh, I'm like Jesus. I don't know why I'm doing Louis XVI's voice like this. Me. Well, it's Louis XVI. I think I will do his voice. You know what's important? Spending more money to show everyone that we're
on
wealthy.
Bigger coats.
On bigger coats while Paris burns. So yeah, his final words, the king's final words, he tries to speak to the group, he speaks to the crowd, and he says, I die innocent of all claims laid to my charge. I pardon those who have occasioned my death, and I pray to God that the blood you are going to shed may never be visited on France. Then he carried on, but then someone started drumming.
It's not being piped off at the Oscars,
it's
isn't it?
Literally. He had a whole thing planned. Big old thing planned. And they're like, no, sorry, but, drum, 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 drum. Charles Henry cut his hair, lowered his head to the guillotine, and the blade fell. The blade that he had helped to design. Some say that it did not cut through cleanly. And Charles Henry had to sort of come up and lean on it, like, just go down there,
go down there,
go down there. Others say it was in clean cut. What he had to do was he had to lift the severed head from the basket and hold it up to the public. And they came forward with their handkerchiefs to soak the blood in the king. Some say he screamed out on his death. Others go, no, that's not possible.
No, probably not. As...
no, your spinal cord's been severed. Yeah. You ain't going to
do
shit.
It's coming, as you're lying there, scream away. But as soon as that blade comes out, you're not screaming anymore.
No, you don't survive after that bit. There's lots of debate about it, lots of debate. There was a famous case that I'll tell it now that, very quickly, I'm paraphrasing. Charles Henry execute Charlotte Corday was a revolutionary assassin. Let's put it that way. She assassinated some of the nobles. She was guillotined. One of the assistants in his team lifted up her head and slapped her face in front of the crowd, and people said that her face had blushed upon the slap, and others said it looked indignant when she slapped, and it made people go, oh my God, is she still functioning for a few seconds?
No.
No, but it was just this act of this person lifting up her head and slapping her face, he was imprisoned. Is that like you, regardless of who she was, you cannot do that to a lady. You can't do that to the dead. But people thought because of the slap, probably there would be blushing, or because like, the blood and everything, but also like that she changed from to, oh!
How dare you?
How dare you? You awful, awful man. He would go on to be the executioner during the Reign of Terror. Charles Henry was in demand. More and more and more famous people came to the guillotine. You have Robespierre.
Didn't work out well for him.
No, it did not work out well for him. His death was quite instrumental. Marie Antoinette.
Yeah.
Actually, technically his son, who did the honours there. Again, all of these people could be worth an episode in themselves. Louis XVI. In total, just under 3,000 people were killed, dispatched by Charles Henry in his career. He wrote of killing 54 people in one day in 1793, going, oh, a terrible day's work.
I'm very busy.
And he also apparently wrote in his memoirs, great citizens and good men follow one another continuously to the guillotine. How many of them will it yet devour? When asked how he felt during an execution, Charles Henry reportedly replied, Monsieur, I'm always in a great hurry to get it over with.
Yes.
Charles Henry would retire in 1795 in full. He handed over the red coat to his son, Henri. Henri had two sons. Luckily, he named them something different than Charles. He had Gabriel, but then another Henri. Henri, his son, carried on to his death in 1840, and he was succeeded by his son, Henri Clermont. he would be the last of the Sandsholes to serve as executioner. Allegedly, this last Henri was terrible at his job. Terrible, had no stomach for it, not prepped, had come out of just simple guillotining execution, like, oh my God, you've not seen anyone broken on the wheel. Became so debt-ridden that he pawned the family guillotine. Is the only way to describe it. His father's guillotine.
Passed down through the generations.
Passed down either all of it or bits of it. And he was then fired by misusing municipal property. The state were like, no.
You can't do that.
Give it back. They bought it back and then fired him. Like, fuck off. But that ended the Sanson line. A last funny little epitaph to the story. And back to our secret ingredient.
Okay.
Originally, Charles Henri had an older son, Gabriel, who was supposed to inherit the red coat. He was supposed to succeed him as executioner. And he did for a time. But he died, tragically, on the scaffold. While holding up a severed head, he slipped on the blood and fell off the scaffold.
Oh, God.
And he died from his injuries. Severed heads, don't play with them.
No, absolutely. It's a fair, I slipped and fell into the guillotine.
Oh, no.
But I fell off the scaffold.
Onto his penis was cut off. Like, oh, no, I was totally testing it. These executioners were stuck with their jobs, forced to administer and endure countless acts of violence. It led to many of them spiralling into depression, drink, misery, debt. We may say, oh, boo-hoo, poor executioners. And to be honest, really, I'm not making a case for sympathy or condemnation either way. It's just a job that literally someone had to do.
Yeah.
And it is uniquely fascinating at that. So that is the story of a family of executioners.
Very good. Oh, I like it.
Ta-da!
Like some good old guillotining.
Oh, yeah, there we go.
Nicely done.
So there's a lot more executioner stories out there. But then I started reading these and I was like, oh no, this is lots.
But then we have to do a Pierpoint one at some point.
Yes.
So
Pierpoint, Albert Pierpoint and the whole family. Fascinating.
From a UK perspective.
But also from in that, you've also got Louis the 16th, if you wanted. You've got Marie Antoinette. You've got all of the murderers who were executed. Lots of bits. French Revolution, if anyone wants to hear about that. It's good fun.
There's a lot of crime out there still to do.
There's a lot of crime that we can cover, Nick, and I think we can do it.
We can do it. We can do all crime by the time we finish.
Pretty much. Yes. Anyway, what do you think of executioners?
I've never really given them a great deal of thought before. I imagine it's a fairly thankless job, really, is it?
It's an interesting moral dilemma. Yeah. What do you do with an executioner? Like, would you Would you be mates with one? I mean, that's a horrible question to ask, but really, you probably would think it.
Yes, probably not. Because I think these days, if someone's an executioner, and there are people out there, not necessarily in the UK, but in certain countries in the world that have capital
punishment. If they are in the UK, I have questions for them. Like, what the hell, mate?
They must be out there. But one would imagine they have chosen that profession. It's not passed down through family lines anymore.
Yes.
So if you are an executioner in a modern sense, then one assumes, yes, that you have fallen into or opted into that profession.
Mm.
In which case, I think we probably wouldn't have a lot to talk about around the dinner table or in the pub of an evening.
Well,
I think we may have different outlooks on life.
But they're not going to talk about that, are they?
Well, no, but I'm imagining one would imagine if you're an executioner, you have to be sort of fairly pro-capital punishment.
And
have that sort of political leanings.
Right, okay,
which
I see where you're going.
Not
there.
Necessarily my political leanings. So I can't imagine I would be in conversation with someone of that.
I was picturing that you had met someone, they walked in going, you know what's great? Capital punishment. Anyway, here's some punch. Really want to talk about hangings. But I'm not an executioner, by the way.
But I'm sure there are people out there who may well know someone who does such a thing.
Bears talking about Albert Pierpoint in the future because he was completely secret from all of his friends. Yeah. None of his friends knew.
No one knew.
And they didn't talk about capital punishment. Yeah. He just would not talk about it. He was a pub landlord.
Very true.
He did
not. So I don't really know how it works in the modern
discuss
sense.
Complete anonymity, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, is that still the case? Is that...
Back then, you couldn't, you know. All you have to do was, like, my hood fell off.
So my mind goes to the States, where certain states have capital punishment and things like that.
And let's be very clear, this happens across the world, so we're not singling out the USA as an example.
But you think there are people there witnessing these things.
Mm.
So they're not wearing hoods anymore.
Yeah.
The people who press the button.
No,
Or any of that. They're not... So obviously then their identity is not secret. They are no longer anonymous. So people must know who these people are, and they must live normal lives as well. So it can't be that they are...
Is it something... God, but it's a whole rabbit hole here, but is it that executions in the modern day, it's got to be the governor or something, or the head of the prison? I know that's a really weird way of saying it, but they're the person responsible for flipping the switch.
Not for flipping the switch. I think they're the person responsible because it's their prison.
It's their decision.
And it's their decision to say, right,
so
yes.
So ultimately they get the responsibility.
They get the responsibility to say, yes, this is going ahead. But they're
the one who does the syringe, or does the button,
or whatever it.
That's a crazy question. Like, so, how can you morally, even if it's just paid a job, and saying like someone has to do this?
Someone has to do that. Someone
and
has to.
This was the case back then. Yeah. It's you're pulling the cord or whatever it is for the guillotine, pressing the button, flipping the switch.
Yeah, but at least then there was
wielding
some
the axe,
anonymity about it, with the simplicity of a hood, which you don't have these days.
People knew you, and they could, and in some cases they were wearing hoods, but. Yeah, well, someone had to do it because you were paid a huge amount of money. And if you're hungry, you're starving, they weren't. They were from a very well-to-do family. But it's much more divisive now than it was then. You have crowds of people turning out. You had campaigners and saying, this is not great, guys, because they were the predecessors of everything for today.
But those campaigners were saying, do it nicely.
Because they knew they weren't going to win.
They knew they weren't going to win. So if we have to do this, we have to do it in a nice way.
Yes, be reasonable, lads. Yeah. I mean, fair play. Fair play to Monsieur Guillotine, yeah. Really, who is the guy it's named after. The inventors get nothing. Madame Guillotine, who was only happy to just ride around a big horse and wear her guillotine earrings, which were in fashion at the time, everyone was wearing them.
Oh, yeah.
It was a big thing. I'd love to get a pair of those. I don't know if I would love to get it morally, but also they look fabulous.
It's a good look.
But Michel Guillotine, the man who was campaigning against capital punishment, said, all you can do is go, right, I'm not going to change your mind, but can we not do the shit on the wheel? Can we not use the boot, the lead, just quick and sudden? And it worked. Mm-hmm. And the guillotine was used for a long time in France.
I think, was it in France? Is it the 50s or something like that? I think it was certainly after the war.
That was when it was used. It wasn't until like the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. It was actually written out of law. It was still there if you need it. Regicide. Like, not that there's been a king. since Napoleon III.
Since the last one, yeah.
Since Louis XVI, it really went downhill. Well, what do you think, people? Executioner is really interesting debate and interesting subject, and there may be other stories you'd like us to cover. Whether they're about executioners or whether there are figures in this story you are hungry for more information on, I'm sure Tim would love to weigh in.
Oh, absolutely.
On some of the Louis. All of them. All great. The they're all great.
They're all mad.
They're brilliant.
All Man in the Iron Mask. Let's do that one.
Go on then.
Okay.
Now, go on.
I'll just watch the Leonardo DiCaprio documentary.
It's a book. If there are more stories you'd like us to cover, let us know. And weigh in on your thoughts of the executioners. Look, you know where we stand on capital punishment, but we would value other people's debate and what it's like where you are. Any insights, welcome and no judgment. Jump on the comments of wherever you listen to this episode, on social media, on any of the channels where you get your podcasts, and tell us what you think. But most importantly, you must mix up. A guillotine!
Mix of a guillotine.
Oh my god, it's so good.
Nice, it's good.
Can we have more of those right now? Because I want more of them.
Can't ask for a better reason than that.
Yeah, pretty much. I, you know what? No debate whatsoever. More, go want more. Fetch. In a nice way.
In a nice way. Get me a fucking drink.
Pretty much. They're just really nice. They're really nice and they're simple. Anyone could make them.
Absolutely.
Mix them up if you can. Share pictures of any of the cocktails that you are making, any of the varieties, the ones that we create. Please share them on social media. Send them to us. We love to see what you are enjoying. If you haven't already, please come and join us on Patreon. And we're going to be recording some of our early episodes.
Apparently, yeah.
Again, because Nick's decided.
Thoughts on that?
Weigh in, people. We'd love to know what you think. Thanks for listening, guys. We have been the people inside the poisoner's cabinet. We will see you next week. And remember, your loved ones are trying to kill you.
Bye.